Dave's comments remind me of the little boy that brought his friend to church. His friend had never been to church, and so he's trying to figure things out. And so the men got up with the collection plates, and he leaned over, and he said, "What does that mean?" The little boy said, "They're about to take up collection." He said, "All right." A little bit later, the song leader got up and opened his book, and the little boy says, "No, what does that mean?" He said, "We're about to sing." He said, "Okay." Preacher got up the front, he opened his Bible and took his watch off and laid it right there, and the little boy says, "What does that mean?" He said, "That doesn't mean anything." I love being at this church. I love being at this church. Hey, I appreciate your endurance. I know I'm getting tired of hearing me, and I admire you for hanging in there, and I hope that our time together can be beneficial. We study a topic for the next few minutes that is one that has surprised me and amazed me, the interest that it stirs. It's good because we need to be concerned about the way God designs us as men. It's sad that the topic seems to stir an interest where individuals see a void in our culture today. We did a big campaign a few years ago that, when I say big, we placed a big emphasis online and a lot of dollars spent advertising. And it was under the 12questions.net umbrella. And we tracked how many times that was hit, how many sermons were listened to, etc. And then about that same time, on just a no-name Sunday night, just kind of a Sunday night sermon that thought maybe was needed, I preached a lesson on masculinity. Our deacon that takes care of our IT, he sent me an email and he said, "I don't know how or why, but this is blowing up." He says, "This sermon's already been listened to thousands of times." I don't know where it was found. I suppose it connected to some kind of search, but it is interesting the number of people in our communities. They are searching for answers of masculinity. And when you stop and think about it, there's very few places that they could go in culture today and learn the truth about what masculinity is. If there is any group that ought to become very attractive to men wanting to be men in America today, there is no group like the Lord's church. When you really start to break it down, it's one of the few places that not only can offer it, but demands it. And that's an intriguing thought, and sad in that our culture has changed that much. Perhaps we look at the changes over the past 125 to 50 years in America, and our first glance would say, most of the changes have been in the role of women. After all, in 1893, it wasn't until Colorado stood up and said, "We're going to be the first state that gives women the right to vote." About 25 years later, in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution gave every woman the right to vote. It wasn't until 1963 that Congress passed the Fair Equal Pay Act, guaranteeing, at least by law, to women that if they did the same work as a man, they deserve the same pay. There are a lot of things culturally that changed in women, and not all good, as we went in the 60s with the introduction of the pill, and then going into the 70s with the legalization of abortion. Putting it in the words of feminists, it was the first time that women could conduct themselves like men sexually, because after all, they wouldn't be burdened with the responsibility of children anymore based on their behavior and decisions. And even in more recent years, in 2013, there was a big change where the ban on women serving in combat roles was lifted. Those are just a few things over the past 125 to 35 years. And some of those changes were needed. Some of those changes were good. not all of them. But then someone stops and gives pause and says, not much has changed with men. Or has it? Today, if you turn on a 30-minute sitcom, which I don't advise you to do, but if you did, and it had a man on there, and especially a man that was a father figure, what's he going to be represented as? Usually, he's the biggest loser on the show. Usually, he's always holding a beer, and he's never showing up for work. And he's usually the butt and the laughing stock of everybody else that's a lot more intelligent on that show than him. Now go back just a few decades and think of another 30-minute show. Think of Andy Griffith. What was the man like on that show? He had an honorable job, and he did it with great loyalty and was respected by everybody in the community. He'd go home to his Aunt Bee and to his son, and he loved them and wasn't ashamed of the fact that he loved them. He would have laid down his life for them. He cared for them deeply. And his friends, they all knew they could count on him. They all considered him a close friend, a good friend. Morally, he was stable. He was solid. And other than the fact that there seems to always be a white lie going on the Andrew Griffith Show, which don't agree with that. But the fact is, masculinity was the common way in that day and time that even Americans, in their entertainment, portrayed men. That's not the common way that men are portrayed today in America. It is a significant change that is not good for America. It's not good for families. It's not good for religious groups. It's not good for a man that's striving to be faithful to God. God expects men to be strong. God expects men to be loyal. God expects men to be courageous. Vern Cleary did a study of his university where he teaches, and he wanted to examine the idea of masculinity, and he gave a survey to the men in his school, and I'm talking about the young men that were enrolled there. And the question, I know that may be kind of a smaller print for you to try to read, but the question is, number six is, how important is it for you to look manly? You know, we'd like to say that 100% of young men that are in college would say it's important, but that's not the kind of young men our culture is raising. But I do want to reveal to you through his research was that 15% said it was very important. And 56.5% said it was somewhat important. So if you link those together, almost 3 out of every 4 young men in America today still believe that it's either very important or at least somewhat important to look or to present themselves manly. Now you might say, well, why isn't it more that think it's very important? Because we're living in a culture that is dumbing down the differences between male and female. We're living in a culture that is presenting everyone as exactly the same. And we're seeing that in the way people talk about marriages. You can't talk now about the man being the head of the home out in secular circles and be respected. Because after all, we're equal partners in this. We're all the same. And if we are all the same, you can't boast of masculinity because that would mean you're implying that you are to be different from being feminine. And so there's great challenges in this for our culture today. When asked where they find their role models, it's interesting that they still look And they can answer more than one, so that's why the percentages here total up far beyond 100%. But 87% said they found it from their fathers, 44% their uncles, 54% their grandfathers, 26% their brothers. Going to the next screen, we even see like a teacher or a counselor in the upper 30%, and even down at the bottom, a friend of a family, 25%. The reason I offer you this slide here is to say to you that when you have young men in your life, whether it's a nephew, it's a grandson, you're teaching a Bible class, you are a mentor to young men, you are a coach, you are a Bible class teacher, you are an elder, you are a deacon, do you realize how hungry and how needed it is for young men today to find mentorship that will provide masculine training? It's desperately needed in our culture today. And as things continue, it's going to be more and more needed, that it is very, very intentional. What'd I just do? Can you turn me back on? Thank you. David Murrow wrote a book several years ago that was on the New York Times bestseller. And the title of the book was something to the effect of Why Men Hate Church. And it really got the attention of America because it struck at the heart of something that not many people had addressed and not many people were willing to address openly. And it was the idea that in a culture in religion that has become very feminine, why would men be drawn to it? And he said, I was sitting in church one day, and I was wondering why I was bored to tears. And he's not a preacher or any kind of leader in the church that he's a part of, and I'm not even for certain what religion he's a part of. But he said, I was sitting there, and then I put on my marketing hat from his profession. And he said, I thought to myself, if I were evaluating religion today based on marketing, who is it marketed toward? And he said, I pictured the foyer I just walked through, and you could tell that women decorated it. And he said, I'm sitting in an auditorium that it's obvious that women had a great influence on decorating it. And I'm listening to sermon week after week that's all soft and tender and feely and touchy. He says, where are those old sermons of a battle cry? Where's the sermons that demand courage anymore? And he said, I'm listening to the songs, this melodious. He says, where are the old spirituals that cry for strength and endurance? Then he said, I looked at my bulletin to see the announcements. And I saw the call to take some food to somebody and to do some sewing and to make some teddy bears. And he said, I saw all these ministries. He said, it became very clear to me that from a professional marketing standpoint, our churches target women 45 years old and up. I'm not asking you to say he's right. I'm just trying to get our minds churning. Is that what the Lord designed? A church that is very, very attractive to middle-aged women and older and elderly women, but not to men and not to young men. Is that what God has designed? Now, out of this, he decided to begin a website. And the website is Church for Men. And what's interesting is that, now are you listening? His mission of his website is not to call men back to the church. The mission of his website is to call churches back to men. I'm not saying all this to advocate his website. I'm just trying to get our minds churning. Who are we? Have we become feminized and don't even know it? I ask you to give that some thought. In that, he shows this exact picture on his website. And he says, this is a picture of a typical church in America today. And he says things like this, which in a minute I'll give you some stats on the screen, but just let me read through some things to get to a closing point here on this slide. He says that statistically, this is the average U.S. congregation this week. He says, I'm going to call it Lakeside. We'll draw from an adult congregation that's 61% female, 39% male, 25% of the married women will attend without their husbands. There'll be a healthy number of single women, but very few single men. And he continues these kind of stats, and we'll look at them in just a minute. But then he says, how did we get here? How did a faith founded by a man and his 12 male disciples become anathema to men? Why do Christian churches around the world experience a chronic shortage of males when temples and mosques do not? Why are church-going men in the Christian faith so hesitant to really live their faith when men of other religions willingly die for theirs? I don't think in my lifetime I've ever been a part of a congregation of the Church of Christ that has not had more faithful Christian women than faithful Christian men. And why? I don't think God designed it that way. And my guess would be in the first century, it was not that way. So why today? Why has that become the norm? And why have we accepted this as the norm? The typical U.S. congregation draws an adult crowd that's 61% female and 39% male. I encourage you to go home and get out your databases, get out your directories. Go home and see what your numbers are. And then begin a journey to try to explore why. Why is it that we attract women but do not attract men? Is there something that's happening that we've become feminized? On any given Sunday, there are 13 million more adult women than men in America's churches. This Sunday, almost 25% of married church-going women will worship without their husbands. Midweek activities often draw 70 to 80% female participants. Over 70% of the boys who are being raised in church will abandon it during their teens and 20s, and many of these boys will never return. Churches overseas report gender gaps of up to 9 women for every adult man in attendance. When we do work in El Salvador, it is so hard to convert the men. It's not just an American thing. It's not just a North American thing. And it's so hard to grow and develop those men into potential leaders because so many of those men do not want to step up and take on the responsibility that comes with being masculine. Christian universities are becoming convents. The typical Christian college in the U.S. enrolls almost 2 women for every 1 man. Now, in the Churches of Christ and colleges associated with that, it's not skewed that much, but it is about a 45-55 gap in our universities. Fewer than 10% of U.S. churches are able to establish or maintain a vibrant men's ministry. Probably most of the congregations we come from would have a strong women's ministry. That's very common to find in the Lord's church. But when you talk to congregations about their men's ministry, what you often hear is, yeah, we tried that for a little while, but it just didn't go. It just didn't fly. Yeah, nothing ever really became of that. Pause and ask yourself why. Why is it that the women can operate a vibrant ministry, but the men have not been able to do that? Have our churches become feminine? Why do men matter? There are various studies. I could quote from two different universities that's done studies, but yet they're so blatantly elementary. You hate to even quote them, but the studies go like this. Anywhere there is a balance of men and women in congregations, those congregations thrive. Those congregations retain their youth. Those congregations have higher contribution. Those congregations have greater growth over periods of time. And it's not because someone has looked up on something and said, wow, we figured it out. Religion needs both men and women. It is because that's the way God designed it. God designed His church to be full of men and women that love Him. His religion was not to cater to women. And so here are some examples like congregational growth, congregational health, unity of the church, increased giving, retention of young men and women. All of these are increased. All of them are healthy when there is an equalization of men as well as women. And so when we look at masculinity, when something makes a noise in the middle of the night, how many husbands are going to nudge their wife and say, go check that out? When you have a flat on a dark, secluded night as it's drizzling rain outside, how many men are going to say, I'll sit here with the car. You go walk and see if you can find somebody to help us. And when you pause and say, why does that not happen? It goes back to the way God created us. The idea of masculinity. God always designed for it to be the men to take the courage, to be the men to be strong, for the men to lead the way. And as one writer said, there's never been a time in America's history that a man can decide to not be a man and it doesn't seem to cost society anything. Now, it's not true. It does cost society. But he said, never has there been a time where a 30-year-old man can live in the basement of his parents' home and play video games all day and be looked upon as all right. Are we ready as men to be masculine and say, that's not all right? Are we ready as men to be masculine and say, let's grow up? There is a reason why first-time marriages are becoming older every year. And one of the reasons is because people do not want to be responsible. If a 25-year-old wants to wait to get married, if the reasons are righteous, God bless them as they wait. But if the reason is this, I'm 25 years old and I do not want to grow up. I do not want to take responsibility. I want to play for the rest of my life. That's not a good reason. And that's where we're suffering today in America. It's fine to be irresponsible. Do you know in the circle of psychology, we don't even know exactly what to do with the term of adolescence anymore. Adolescence used to be whenever you were able to be responsible for yourself. You left the teenage years, you went into college, you graduated from college, or before you decided not to go to college, you went to the military, you went to work, and you became independent. You moved out of mom and dad's house. You provided by your own hands your own work, and you provided your own food. You were mature enough, responsible enough, to be in a relationship, responsible enough to be able to have a healthy relationship, get married, have children. And oftentimes that was done by the early to mid-20s. And now those things in America are not being done until 31, 32, 33. And so now, what are we supposed to call an adolescent that's 28 years old. Because that is the common 28-year-old today. And so psychologists are embarrassed to continue to call them what they are. And so we're trying to come up with new terms. And you better believe over the next 5 years, you're going to hear a lot of new terms that describe the 22-year-olds up to the 34-year-olds that in essence what they've said is, I just want to play. I don't want any responsibility. I don't want to be a man. It wasn't that many decades ago you could walk up to a 15-year-old and say, son, what do you want? What are you looking forward to in life? And he'd tell you where he looked forward to working one of these days. He'd tell you about how I look forward to being married and I look forward to having a family. You find a 15-year-old today that'll tell you where they're looking forward to work. And you know why you don't find them? Because we're not raising men. We're raising sissies. We're raising irresponsible children that remain children until their 30s. Until finally, not their parents, but life or something helps them wake up and grow up. And in essence, they've lost 15 years of their life. And all that I've just said, if it sounds like I'm blaming the young people, I promise you I'm not blaming the young people. If it sounds like I'm putting all the blame on the parents, I'm not putting all the blame on the parents. I'm telling you, in a setting like this, we don't have time to diagnose where it all lies. I'm just trying to pull back a curtain a little bit and say, we've got to deal with this. In our families and in our congregations, we must deal with this. Masculinity is beautiful. Masculinity is the way God designed it. Calling young men to grow up and be men is what God would call them to do. We're not coming up with something new and we're not giving them a charge that's unique. We're taking them back to something that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And it comes from God Himself. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to go down. And not as a speaker, that would never happen, to go down and be in the audience of a what is called a scholarly lectureship. Now, you got to brace yourself for those. What that is where a lot of doctorates are invited in, and it's either them reading their papers or them doing doctrinal level studies, and whatever their studies, they're reading their papers. And so if you go into one of the lectureships, it's 45 minutes of a doctor reading his studies. And if you're on a good topic that you have interest in, it's really good. And if you don't have interest in it, it's a long 45 minutes. And so there were some of those lectureships that I went in. I was like, wow, that's good stuff. And there's others, I didn't walk out of there saying that because it just didn't interest me. And they can go very, very deep talking about wheels of a chariot. And so there was only one exception, that entire lectureship, and where there wasn't a doctor speaking. And they had one of their grad students to speak. His name was Caleb Cochran. And they introduced Caleb, and they said, Caleb has just finished his thesis. And he decided to study masculinity from the Pauline corpus. And said, we were so impressed with his paper that we asked him if he could condense his 270-page paper into a 45-minute presentation. And he said he could. So now we're going to hear Caleb Cochran speak on masculinity. It really was good. What he did to do his research was he decided that he would study masculinity as it was presented in literature in the first century. Just like today, if you want to go and see what masculinity looked like in the 60s in America, you watch the Andy Griffith Show. If you want to see what people's view of men are in 2005, 2010, you can look at some of our literature. And you get it. Well, you can do that in first century. Okay, in first century literature, who are the heroes? What do they look like? When stories are told about families, what do the men look like? And so he did that to get a flavor of what in Greek and Roman literature of the first century men were being presented. Then he turned around to Paul's writings and he said, now they would have been people that would have understood manhood like this. What did Paul say to those people? What he came up with was he says there are about 9 or 10 characteristics that seem to ring true to describe what manhood ought to look like in the way God designed it. Now, as we go into this list of 9 or 10 things, I want to take a little bit of air out of your sail. And I almost hate to do this, but it's only fair to do this. When we read in Scripture, Scripture was given to men and women. So there are going to be several of these things that we read that you could very quickly say, hey, I hear you, but shouldn't women do those same things? And the answer is going to be yes. But the way it's worded or the way it's presented or the context around it, there's just something about the things that's brought out here that makes it clear that these are things, these are characteristics that God expects men to carry out in order to be masculine. The first one I'd like for you to see that he brought out was that of courage. Yes, women are to be courageous. But there's something about the way God speaks, like to Joshua in Joshua, the first chapter, where 3 times he told him to be strong and courageous and to not be afraid. And when we think about the manliness of even the very religion that we speak, Paul said the only thing that he could preach is Christ and Him what? Crucified. For just a moment, hear that. Are you ready? Wipe your slate clean. Hear that for the first time. Hey, I've been thinking about the religion you're a part of. Paul, can you tell me something about your religion? Like, what does it go back to? What's the core of it? Everything we're a part of goes back to a Lord that was crucified. Where's the feminine touchy-feely about that? How have we lost it? Is it that we teach and ask too little? In 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, and for time's sake, we're not going to be able to look up most of these, but I'm going to turn to that one in my Bible, and if you turn in yours, we may have different translations, and you're going to note that this has different words that's translating this word out of the Greek, because this Greek word is kind of hard to put into English. I'm reading out of the New King James here, and it says, watch, stand face. Now, you know that this is the end of 1 Corinthians 16. There's only a couple paragraphs left. And so he's kind of closing things out, but he's giving them that charge. And so he says, watch, stand fast in the faith. Now, here's the word. Be brave, be strong. Now, I love the King James on this. Even though it still is a little bit like we don't speak today, the King James is quit you like men. Or the New American Bible would say, act like men. Or the NIV would say, be men of courage. But think about that literal, that word. Not just the message that he's saying to the church. The message that he's saying to the church is, I expect you to put like a line in the sand, and I expect you to say, I'm standing here, and I will not move. But what about when the enemy comes? You watch for him, but you do not lose ground. Stand firm. Well, what about if you're afraid? It doesn't matter how afraid you are. Don't let your fear turn you away from what you believe. Be courageous. Your courage has to be greater than your fear. And so the language, whether you're a man or a woman, the message is the same. Be courageous. Stand your spiritual ground. But what word did he use? Out of the original Greek, he used the word that says, I expect you to be like a man. Wait a minute. Well, what do you mean, I expect you to be like a man? Well, the idea of manhood is a man's not going to turn and run. You're telling me a man's never afraid? No. I'm telling you the man's not going to turn and run. When it's his responsibility, he has enough courage to stand there and do what needs to be done. Even with Paul mentoring Timothy, who we don't know all that was going on in Timothy's life, but when we read 1 and 2 Timothy, we get the idea that he was struggling a little bit with fear, a little bit with a lack of courage. And Paul tells him about the suffering that he is enduring, and he calls him to be courageous and to be willing to suffer that same kind of endurance. A second thing that we see is that of self-control. Now, we know that that's for everybody. The fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5 involves self-control. But I would like for you to think with me of the idea of a teenage boy throwing a temper tantrum. And his older brother, I'd almost say wisely, says to him, "Get over it, crybaby." Why would his brother call him a crybaby just because he was losing his temper? Because there's nothing masculine about losing control. Masculinity is the idea of maintaining control of self. I want you to just envision a Western that maybe you really like. Or maybe there's an old war movie that you really like. And if I were to say to you, describe to me the hero in that movie, and then I say, why do you like them? You would start describing a man that everything around could seem to be falling apart, and he could just maintain his composure. And everybody around could be losing it, and he could just stay so calm and make the decisions that need to be made. And people would say, now, that's a man's man. Why? Because he's exemplifying a part of the epitome of masculinity. Masculinity is the ability to practice self-control. And of course, as Christians, we are to gain that through the fruit of the Spirit, not through our own being, but it's men being called to be strong men. And men that are being controlled by the Spirit of God should be the strongest of men. And so when you see a husband losing his control and cursing at his wife and yelling at his children and throwing something, he's proven that he's not masculine. Now, he may have people afraid of him, but he's proven he is not masculine. The third thing that we see is that of endurance. Endurance has always been a part of masculinity. When Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 4, I know when I maybe go to a workshop, I like for a preacher, if I'm a preacher, to throw out a little bit of tidbits. So I'll throw one out for you preachers. If you've never preached the bookends of 2 Corinthians 4, 1 and verse 16 are bookends where both times Paul says, I do not lose heart. How can you go through all the things Paul went through and not lose heart? Well, you preach what is between verse 1 and verse 16, and that's how we do not lose heart. That's a great study on endurance. How is it that you don't quit? How is it that you can get to the end and know that the persecution is still coming, even to the point of death, 2 Timothy 4, verse 6 through 8, and instead of crying and saying it's terrible and they're going to take my life and I don't know what I'm going to do, can somebody come rescue me? Can somebody get me out of here? They're going to kill me. Instead, he can calmly say, the time of my departure is at hand. I'm ready. I've fought. I've ran. I've kept. I'm ready. How do you get to that place of endurance? We're under self-control, but really God's control. You can persevere. It's a great mark of masculinity. Again, whenever you see someone just quit, how many times have you seen a quitter? and someone look over to him and genuinely say, I tell you what, you're a real man. No. Nobody's going to say that. Because that's not what masculinity is about. Masculinity is not about quitting. Masculinity is about enduring. A man that quits on his kids is not masculine. A man that quits on his wife is not masculine. A brother that quits and no longer serves the Lord is not masculine. A leader that quits on his responsibility in the Lord's kingdom is not masculine. And we continue with a really obvious one, and that is the characteristic of strength. It's almost universal. Anywhere you go, any culture, any civilization, you just expect men to be stronger. It's almost a measuring stick in some degrees of masculinity, who is the strongest man. And so oftentimes in Scripture, using athletic illustrations and even talking about strength, like in 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 9, or Philippians 4:13, that I can do all things through Christ who what? Strengthens me. It's this idea that we must be strong and we need to be strong. We've already mentioned Joshua being told by God to be strong and courageous three different times. In other words, not to be a sissy, not to be weak, but to be strong. Also, when we look at masculinity, we see, and again, this is unique to the Lord's church and His teachings, but we see that of authority. According to God's plan, it's going to be individuals who are masculine that are going to be elders, those that will oversee the congregations of His church. According to God's plan, it's going to be masculine individuals that's going to be deacons. When we read in 1 Timothy 2, according to God's plan, if the whole church is gathered together, it's going to be men that are offering the prayers and leading the classes. And even when we go back to our homes, according to God's plan, it's going to be men that lead in the homes. We must give great effort to training men to be leaders, to train them how to humbly excel at authority. There's some guys that want authority and they abuse it. There's some guys that are irresponsible and they don't want any authority. And what we need is men who are masculine, that they don't run from responsibility because it's hard. Of course responsibility is going to be hard. It always is. It's responsibility. And so they don't look at the position. I remember one time looking over at a guy. It's just one of those things. It's frozen in time. We were in a long discussion, and at this part of the discussion, we'd made our way to his vehicle. And finally, as we were approaching his vehicle, finally he just looked over at me and he said, "This is it. I just don't want to have to do the work of an elder." He said, "It's going to be hard." And I looked over at him. And I said, "Yeah, and what if every man felt that way?" Because the congregation we were a part of was desperate for men to be elders. And you think how convenient it is to just say, "That's a lot of responsibility. That's a lot of work. You know, all I've got to do is say, no, I don't want to do it," and whoo, all that work I don't have to do. Are you kidding me? You are going to turn down works to bless the kingdom just because it's hard. Where's the man in that scenario? We must raise up men who welcome the opportunity to be men. I probably should have thrown this out at the beginning. I'll just kind of interrupt for just a moment to lighten things a little bit. My wife, wonderful lady, she is one of three sisters. So she grew up in a home with no boys. I love her mom and dad, and I love her sisters. I love the family. Couldn't say enough good about them. I love them deeply. But their family is kind of like a family of girls. And so we had our first child on the way. Before the days of, hey, let's check out and see what this kid is, we found out when he was born. He was a he. And so we go home with our newborn baby that's a son. And I'm watching, you know, a little cute little feminine lady that just everything in her life is feminine and everything in her life is sweet and tender and just the most nurturing woman. And I said, look, we got to have a talk. And she says, what is it? And I said, listen, you need to understand, we're not going to raise a sissy. And she kind of smiled. She didn't know what to do with it. And I said, no, I'm serious. Like, we need to get on the same page. We're going to raise a man. And I want you to be sweet to him and all that. But you've got to understand, there are going to be some times that we're going to go out and do something, and you're going to say, he's going to get hurt. And I want you to just like turn around and go the other way. Because you're right, he is going to get hurt. But we're going to raise him to be tough, to be strong, and to be a man. The last thing we will ever do is raise a sissy. Now, we're not going to raise a bully. We're not going to raise a hateful, disrespectful man. But we're going to raise a child that knows what masculinity is. Men, we have got to figure out what God created us to be. And we've got to get past this thing that it may hurt, or it may be extra work, or it may be difficult, and we need to get back to what God has called us to be. Now, I know this one may seem out of place, and I'll go ahead and throw this out. I'm even on your side if when you look at this, when you say, that's kind of offensive to me because I look at myself as being masculine, but I hate public speaking. And I get you if that's what you're saying. And so I want to try to clarify this. I want you to think about this from not just the way we look at public speaking, maybe in the church where we say, oh, that's talking about the preacher. Or that's talking about the guy that stands up and teaches the auditorium Bible class. I want you to think about the idea of what we've already looked at. God has placed authority upon the man. And God expects the man to be the leader. And God expects the man to be courageous. How are you going to lead your home if you cannot effectively communicate with the people in your home of the direction we're going? I'd like for you to think about that, A to B. As head of your home, can you at least effectively communicate to your family, look, this is the direction we're going. When a teenage girl or boy in an upset situation says, my dad never talks to me. That's what this is talking about. Can you address the people you're trying to lead? If you're the leader as a deacon over a ministry, can you at least stand before the people you're leading and lead them? Can you communicate with them? If you're an elder, can you stand before the people you lead and can you effectively communicate with them? Leadership demands that. Masculinity demands that. Imagine you're great. Not that this is a standard. I'm just giving you an illustration. Imagine that movie that you say, I love that military movie. And imagine whether it's your general or your sergeant or whoever it is that's the hero of that movie. Imagine it comes that moment where he's going to challenge the troops and we're going to march in. And it comes time and he says, I just never was good at speeches. I can't do this. Nobody would look at that and say, now that's a man. Masculinity says, you know, I believe in the cause and I believe in the people I'm leading, and I can verbalize that. I can put into words what needs to be said. If you still have kids at home, don't ever stop tucking them in bed at night. And when you do that, just sit down and talk a while. More importantly, let them talk a while. Listen and talk. Listen and talk. We must realize how important it is as men to be communicators. But then also, the male body itself is masculine. It's strong. Oftentimes it's athletic. They're very much male traits. I know this isn't politically correct to say today, but it wasn't that many years ago that if a woman was very agile and athletic, someone would say she is what? And meaning she's a lot like a man. And then that wasn't necessarily a criticism. If she was a basketball player and she could move well, it was saying she's athletic like a man. But now in our correct political correctness, we can't say that. But that's literally what's meant by that. It's the idea that says masculinity is the strength. Masculinity is the athleticism. And so when we look at this, we see even the examples in Scripture that pertain to using this idea of being strong, of being disciplined. Also, we see the male sexuality. We see in 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, in verse 1 through 5, that if we take a wife, that we are to give her our body and vice versa. But also, I'd like for you to notice this is very different from what our world would say. Our world would oftentimes visualize the idea that a real man has a woman in every town. A real man has a different woman every weekend. Now, I probably don't have to tell you this to know it, but I do want to tell you this to emphasize it. Real masculinity is whenever a man has the ability to practice self-control and to build a strong and enduring relationship with one woman. Amen. And that is sexual masculinity. And all of the other things that Satan would throw at us are perversions. They're lies. They're deceit. They're far from truth. And so to be able to restrain oneself and to keep oneself pure and the ability to be faithful to one woman, those are masculine behaviors that we need to esteem. And it ties right into the next one, and that is of being a family role model. When we look at Ephesians 5, and we see this great instruction on husbands and wives, who is to be the leader in this? Who's to be the role model in this? It's supposed to be the husband. And we go into Ephesians 6 and we see who's to be the leader of the children. It's to be the father. We go to 1 Peter 3 and 7. Who's to be the knowledgeable leader? The reason I say knowledgeable, remember that's the passage that says dwell with them according to knowledge. Who's going to know their wife? Going back to, are we sitting down or are we listening? Who's going to know their children? Right now, how nervous would I get? How nervous would you get if we passed out a test and your test was about your own family? What if it was asking your wife's favorite book, her favorite color, her favorite number, her favorite song, her favorite color, her favorite flower? How many of us would get nervous and say, I don't know how well I'm going to do? What if we did the same thing with your very own kids? How many of us say, I just don't do good at that stuff? That's not masculine. Masculinity says, I'll be the role model in my family. I'll be connected to my family. I'll lead my family. We can't lead people we do not know. If you've never done a study on the simple word among, it is a very powerful word in leadership. Did Jesus sit in some ivory palace? Not according to John 1 and 14. What did He do? He came among us. Amen. And then turn over to 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, and see how elders are supposed to live. Elders in God's eyes aren't in boardrooms with closed doors. Even though there's a lot of decisions that have to be made, when God describes elders, He describes them living among the people. And that's why He continually used the illustration of the shepherd. Because where do shepherds live? Among the sheep. I grew up on a farm that raised cattle. Have you ever heard of a ranch-style house? Have you ever heard of a shepherd-style house? You've never heard of the shepherd-style house because they don't have a house. They live among the sheep. The guy that takes care of the ranch, he goes and he lives in his house. And once a day or once every 2 days, he just goes out and he counts sheep and then he goes back to his ranch-style house. It's a big difference in the leadership the Lord wants. What the Lord wants is He wants leadership where we live among the people that we lead. Not above them, not separate from them, among them. When we look at the family role of leadership, it is a masculinity, that's a mentality that we live truly among. And so the question is, when we think about masculinity, do we honor it? Do we model it? Do we expect it? Do we teach it? Do we mentor it? You take men out of the home, and government is oftentimes invited in. You take men out of the church, and oftentimes women step up into leadership position. You take men out of the culture, and masculinity disappears, and our society is weakened. We may not can change the whole world, but we can change the world we live in. And we must decide not what the culture says about masculinity, but what does God say? Amen. And will we stand with her? Let's bow.